podcasts. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales and this is the show where we sit down with Christians from all walks of life to hear more about their testimony, life and career. And today, I'm actually sitting in a pub in Eastbourne with the award-winning comedian Andy Kind. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sam.
You are hours away from playing in Eastbourne.
That's right.
At a church, yeah. At a gig. So just gone 4 o'clock and I'm probably interrupting your pre-stand-up routine. What does your pre-show routine look like?
No, it involves sitting in secluded places drinking coffee, which is what I'm doing now. So, I probably 2 hours before a gig, I become really antisocial and I do have to think about what I'm doing. Even after sort of 2,000 gigs, I do need to know what's going on because it's muscle memory and you need to be focused and you need to be clear-headed. But we've still got some time before I totally blank you.
So being known as a comedian, is there any kind of pressure, even in a conversation like this, to have to be funny?
Not anymore. No, I remember when I first started, I would try and show off. I mean, I am a natural show-off. Comedians are either naturally depressed or naturally show-offs, and I'm the latter category. But when I first started, I think I was so keen to prove that I was funny that I would try and do it everywhere. And having been at school and been told, yeah, you're funny, you're the funniest in our class, I always did play up to that a little bit. I went chasing after that. But, you know, I've been a comedian for 13 years. It's the only job I've ever needed. And I've done 2,000 gigs around the world. Like, I don't really have anything to prove anymore. I mean, it doesn't mean everyone thinks I'm funny or...
Sure.
And that's fine. All opinions are available, but I'm much more content in my ability to do the job.
Yeah. I'd love to talk a bit more about how it all sort of started in the early days. But here on the show, we always like to go right back to the beginning and talk about someone's life growing up. And I understand you are originally from Stoke-on-Trent.
Yeah, well, I was born in Birmingham. Yeah, but I was raised from the age of three in Newcastle-under-Lyme, which is just outside Stoke-on-Trent. But I always say Stoke because a lot of people think Newcastle-under-Lyme is Geordie land,
right,
and you drink Newcastle Brown and you're related to Gaza and things like that. So I'm from Newcastle-under-Lyme, which is a little town within the Potteries really, and moved there when I was three, raised there and lived there pretty much on and off until I was 27, so it is still home to a degree. Yeah,
sure. Where did Christian faith come in? Was that part of your childhood growing up?
Yes and no, really. So mum and dad are both Christians, and so I grew up in a Christian household. You know, a household can't be Christian, but you know what I mean? Only people can be Christian. Mum and dad both Christians, and so went to church, went to a Christian fellowship. I remember when I was quite small, the charismania of the 1980s, I think, was at its peak. And then mum moved us to an Anglican church, and... The gospel I believe now and the gospel I preach now is not the gospel I was raised on or the gospel that I believed as a younger person. But I've also never been an atheist. I've always just very easily seen God's existence and God's hand at work. And I remember when I was sort of 5 or 6 years old, I had a really bad nervous twitch. And my mum prayed for me. She put a hand on my head and she said, I'm going to pray for you now. And I felt really dizzy. I said, Mum, what's going on? I feel really dizzy. She said, well, that's just the Holy Spirit. And the twitch went. I was healed of that twitch. And so from a very early age, I had a real sense of God, God's existence and his ability to do stuff. So, yeah, but as a young teenager, I played football on a Sunday. The church we went to was a kind of classic, sleepy, parochial Anglican church. So it was all very much, Father God, we do thank you for this day on the night before he was betrayed. And I got to the point where I thought, you know, I love God and I know him to a degree, but this doesn't have anything to say to me. This isn't, what is this? You know, going to church and it's jamming Jerusalem, thinking, well, what, there's a discrepancy somewhere. And I was in my mid-20s by the time I reconciled those things, yeah.
Because you say now that the gospel you understand now is not necessarily the same as the one you were brought up with. So what exactly has changed?
I inherited middle-class Christianity, where the main aim is really to make something of yourself. Of course, Philippians 2 tells us of Jesus that not considering equality with God something to be grasped, he made himself nothing. So if I'm trying to make something of myself following a guy who made himself nothing, well, something's gone wrong there. There's a disparity there somewhere. So yeah, I inherited a middle-class Christianity where the good news was basically that I was raised in the West. And that's not the good news of the gospel. My inheritance, the Bible tells me, is something that can never spoil, perish or fade. And it's things like love and joy and hope and peace and freedom and fullness of life. It's not Netflix and a graduate job and a mortgage and a nice garden when I retire. That's not my inheritance. So I am an evangelist now. I am a preacher. So you reflect a lot more. And if you hear the gospel alongside British imperialism or a particular political view, well, it's no longer just the gospel. It gets co-opted by other things and it loses its power. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it reminds me of Jesus talking about it's hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. Mm. And I think even myself, when I hear that, I think, oh yes, it's hard for the millionaires.
Yeah.
You kind of forget that, oh, actually, I am probably one of the people Jesus was talking about, if you take a global perspective.
Yeah.
And you're not the only person to point out the church is very middle class. That seems to be a criticism that I'm hearing more and more. Is there a simple answer to that question? Because clearly we're not expecting those who are middle class to announce their faith. That can't be the way forward.
No. The simple answer, this is it. Are you ready for this? The simple answer is deny yourself, pick up your cross, and follow him. I don't want that to be the answer. So, you know, you, as a preacher, you preach to yourself, first of all, and it's there. It's all there, and it's really hard. I do this thing where I read the psalm of my age as my sort of psalm for the year. So I'm 37 now.
And that's really interesting.
It's
really
brilliant.
Different.
It's brilliant. So I try and read it like once a fortnight. And there's a bit where it says, the Lord establishes a man's steps and takes pleasure in his way. Though he will fall, he will not be overwhelmed because the Lord holds his hand. And I just think, you know, the joy of grace is that, yeah, you are going to fall, but you're not going to be overwhelmed because I've got you. I've got you. And I take pleasure in your way, which means that even when you're on the ground falling, I'm not judging you. I'm not condemning you. There is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And it's so freeing. It's not just behave well, otherwise God will... It's not behave well, otherwise God will be angry. It is as a result of the love that we can experience through God and our relationship with God. Behaviour comes from that, but behaviour is secondary to relationship. Like, I wouldn't want to live or die by this, but I heard someone that you become an average of the five people you're closest to. Hmm. And I don't think that's necessarily totally true, but there's something in it, isn't there? And so if one of the five people you know best is Jesus, then you're doing pretty well. But I think we're always being discipled by something and someone at some point. When none of us are neutral, none of us are free thinkers. We are all vessels and we absorb stuff. You know, if you listen to R&B or hip hop for an hour, and then you listen to Classic FM for an hour, your mindset and your behavior will be different after those two experiments, just because of how we sponge-like absorb things. Mm.
So going back to your story, you went to university, studied French.
Mm.
And
French with Italian.
And after that, managed to sort of wind up in comedy. How did that happen?
I was trapped. I was tricked. I needed the money. I was like a comedy mule, smuggling comedy across the border. I always wanted to be a comedian. I remember being...
So why did you study French?
Well, because of the middle class thing, I went to private school, and throughout private school, I was told that I would go to university, and I never really wanted to, but I was just told that that's what you do, and you do the thing that you're best at, and I was best at French. I found it easy, and I found everything else quite hard. Picked it, went to university, never really wanted to use it as part of my job, always wanted to be a comedian. When I was in first year at high school, we had to write about our idols, and people were picking Martin Luther King and Florence Nightingale. I chose Rowan Atkinson because I wanted to have a lovely face, a lovely expressive face. But I always wanted to be a comedian. That just never went away. And you realise that the people who have the money and are offering you jobs actually don't really care where you've been to university or how you did at university. That may have been the case a while ago. So yeah, I think I gravitated towards the thing that I really wanted to do, which was to make people laugh. And my gift has always been communication. And my love has always been making people laugh. I just love the sound of laughter. So I think having become quite quickly disillusioned with what the world of work actually was and the rat race and being a graduate was, I just thought this says, to quote Morrissey, it says nothing to me about my life. This is not what my life is. So having worked in London for 6 months in a sales job, I quit that. And then I just thought, you know what, I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to give comedy a go, because if I don't, then I will, it's the classic cliche, I'll always regret it. Mm. And I don't think I expected it to work. I didn't expect it to work. I went to the Comedy Store in 2004 and saw a bill that included Omid Jalili and Addy van der Borg and Ben Norris, amazing comedians. And I came away from that thinking, I could never be good enough to do that. But then I've got a poster from 2009 where it says, it's a gig in London, and I was the host, and on that bill were two of the same people from that Comedy Store gig 4 years previous. And I remember coming away from that gig in 2009 thinking, I did what I didn't think I could do.
Just travelling around doing stand-up wherever people will pay you, basically.
Not even that sometimes. Yeah, so I started comedy in 2005. January 23rd, 2005, went down to Bath. I talk about this in my first book, Stand Up and Deliver, available from eden.co.uk and other places where it's cheaper. But I just started registering on all these different websites, and I look back at my material now and I think, I don't know, that was the grace of God, because I don't know how that material went down so well. I went along to watch a gig in Stoke with my friend Ben. I went up to the promoter. I had no idea how comedy worked. I went up to the promoter and I said, hello, I'm a comedian. Can I do a gig at some point in the future? That isn't really how it worked. And the promoter said, well, it's interesting that there's a guy called Mahinder Suniara who was supposed to be on next, but he's stuck on the M6 in traffic. Do you want to go on now? Wow. I was like, yeah, I do. And I went on and again got voted man of the match at the end, had an amazing gig, don't know how. But I came off stage and I ran my mum and said, Mum, this is what Jesus wants me to do. This is a confirmation of what of me doing this. And that was it. That was it. And it was just that sense of, you know, like the Red Sea parting, if you like. Something seemingly impossible happening and me kind of just walking into it. So it's been really hard. I've given up twice over the last 13 years. But I've always been resurrected, partly because I've realised I'm not very good at anything else. Like, I have a really limited skill set.
When you gave up, what did that look like?
You're only 3 consecutive bad gigs away from giving up. And so that's happened twice. In 2006, I was only still a baby, really, in comedy terms. I had 3 gigs. I thought, I can't do this. I'm not good at this. This is failed. I've given it a go, but I failed. I don't know how to get out of this slump. And I said, if I do badly in my next gig, that is it. My next gig was on Easter Sunday 2006, and I had a good gig, not a great gig, but I had a good gig. And I remember thinking, okay, no, I can keep going. It's I've stopped the rot, and I've reversed the polarity. Later on, I just got to the stage. Yeah, 2011, I was doing a gig in Harpenden. It was for a New Frontiers Church, but it was in a school hall in Harpenden. And it was going really well. I was doing really well. And in the break, I remember on my notepad writing down for the second half, new Peppa Pig joke, stuff about Grandad. I don't want to do this anymore. And I didn't realise I was writing it. I just wrote, I don't want to do this anymore. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'd got to the stage where I was doing a lot of gigs for churches, and I was really serving well, but I was kind of having to forego a lot of creative license. You become the comedian of the gigs you perform. You become your decisions. You know, we become what we behold. And so, doing gigs for churches, you can talk about wanting to push the envelope and, you know, push boundaries and stuff, but actually, you want to keep getting booked and you want to keep getting paid, and most churches will, you know, they want it to be safe. They're not really interested in the creative or the artistic license. They're not wanting to promote your art so much, they want to put on an event that will be a safe and quality event, but safe event for them to invite friends. And so there's buffers in place there. And I think I just got the stuff I was writing and wanting to write increasingly was disparate from and separated from the stuff that was working. And I just thought, this isn't what I want anymore.
What you just said there, though, about churches, they don't necessarily want you to push the envelope. They don't want to increase your creativity or enhance your art. I mean, isn't that exactly why so many artists I know do grow disillusioned with the church?
I think that is it. And look, you know, I'm not... I absolutely love the church and want to build up the body, and I don't want to tear down. And actually, you don't want people coming along and... like ridiculous risks being taken which break relationships with seekers and the wider community. Of course I see that. I think also though that we can then become too fear based, and the thing the Bible says more than anything else is do not fear. It doesn't say anything as much as it says that. So one of the things we do really well at the moment is championing the poor, I think, actually, as a church, like food banks, Christians Against Poverty, fantastic. Well, I think we are nailing that. We are so bad at championing people's artistic gifts to the point of cursing people. And I don't mean, woo, I just mean, you know, for me, a curse is if you hear a lie enough times, you'll believe it. And that's a curse. And as an example, if you go to your church leader and you say, I feel like God's called me as a missionary to Africa, they'll be like, oh, this is amazing, fantastic. Oh, God's really on you. The Holy Spirit's really anointing you. What we'll do, we'll put you on our prayer list and we'll support raise for you. And we'll get a picture of you. We'll put it on the notice board attached to a map via a piece of thread or kind of ribbon. And people will know that you're doing that. If someone comes to the pastor or the church leader and says, I feel like God's calling me as a missionary to the arts, what will tend to happen, not universally, but generally, is... well, that's interesting. It's interesting you've got that hobby. Why don't you get yourself a normal job, and then at Christmas you can help us with our nativity, because that will help you with your artistic gift, won't it? I mean, that is lots of people's story. And yet...
Unless they're a worship leader.
Unless they're a worship leader. And again, like we're brilliant at discipling worship leaders. I'm not trying to tear down that, but... Who's championing
well,
the performance poets?
Yeah.
Like nobody really, and no one likes poetry. But we should still be champion. But do you know what I mean? It's yet the first thing. If you look at those two examples, the first thing that most people in our society do when they get home is not see what's going on in Kenya or, you know, Uganda. They put on the TV, and you'll hear loads of people saying, "Oh, it'd be really good if there were more authentic Christian characters on TV." But who's supposed to write them? If we're going to have Christian characters, we need to have Christian screenwriters. But who's discipling them? Where are they supposed to come from? What I'm really passionate about, and again, I'm not answering the question you asked, but I've had Diet Coke and I've had coffee, and I'm just off.
We should say you are drinking both a Diet Coke and a coffee right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And presumably this is all to help with later.
I'm the
on
bad boy. I'm the bad boy of the evangelical world, Sam.
We're sitting in a pub, and you being a bad boy is drinking two soft drinks.
Yes. Yes.
Excellent.
I said I'm a bad boy, I'm not a heathen. I'm not a backslider, so. He says, tongue firmly in cheek. What was I saying?
I don't know.
No,
but
I don't know.
It was
know.
Really great.
Yeah, I was enjoying it. I felt really anointed.
A lot of what you were just saying, I guess, brings us quite neatly on to one of the projects you're involved in, which, as I understand it, is running a retreat centre.
Yes.
And I know part of that, as you say, is discipling people in the arts. So do you want to talk specifically about this retreat centre and how that came about?
Because I don't really want to talk about the retreat centre, because it... okay, now we'll talk about it, because actually I'm very good... I talk a good game, and I'm very good at making myself sound impressive. I made a big mistake. So I took my family to Yorkshire from Manchester to run this retreat centre, thinking that we would turn it into this amazing creative art place, and we haven't. I haven't done it because I couldn't do it, because I'm not capable of it. My skill set is much more limited than I thought, and I don't have a team around me. And so actually the retreat centre runs well, but it runs as a retreat centre. Mm-hmm. And I have found myself like completely isolated and lonely, and actually, you know, really bored and quite embarrassed, because I had these big dreams, these big pictures, and like I do feel like the Lord said to go there. I think he gave us warnings, but he also said, look, you know, this is the right move. And I'd become quite disillusioned again with just doing church outreach gigs, you know, being the, at one point being described, I don't know who it was, but being described as the golden boy of the charismatic evangelical outreach world. I mean, that doesn't mean anything, but it, but I remember thinking, is that who I am? Am I the guy they, you know, chinook in for alpha launches? Because even then, I was like, well, I still don't see the fruit of that. I make people laugh, and then they sign up for alpha, and I don't even know what happens as a result of that. I become disillusioned with, again, just doing gigs that weren't gigs, and I wanted something new, and I didn't want to. We just had our second daughter, and I didn't want to be away from my girls, or you know, wife and two girls, away for so long. So it did mean moving to this retreat centre that I'd be more localised, be more centralised, I'd have more time with the girls. And it wasn't a mistake because God said go. But on a professional level, on a personal level, it was a mistake. And it is a failure in terms of, and bearing what I said earlier about there's no condemnation, I don't feel guilty or ashamed, but just looking at it objectively, I see that the thing I set out to do, I misjudged and have failed at. And that's okay, because actually there's a new season on its way, hopefully, and I wouldn't have wanted to. I didn't want to preach the gospel when I moved to Westwood, and now I do want to, and that's what I feel is the calling for the rest of my life. Yeah. But I've had to really, again, to sound quite, you know, charismatic evangelical, I feel like I'm really going through a desert right now. And that's true. But I listened to an amazing Mike Pilavachi talk, where he talked about David being anointed king and then going back to being a shepherd. And the message was, don't be afraid to partner with obscurity. And I think having been quite well known within the Christian world, the evangelical Christian world, as a comedian, as a reliable person doing all the festivals, to suddenly remove myself from that has been difficult, but also really important, because when I get released back into the wild, if you like, it will be properly as a preacher, and there's just a different character needed.
Yeah.
You know, comedy is self-elevating by its nature. Preaching is self-denying and Jesus elevating. And it's all very well saying these things, but the stuff that needs to happen internally. You can do a comedy gig and be spiritually nowhere. So, you can't preach. You can't preach and be spiritually nowhere.
So I mean, this is quite a kind of progression, a change. We sort of started out doing. And it's not.
I realise there's been a tonal shift as well in the interview. So.
But it's not that you started out doing stand-up and no longer do that, but that was the main thing. And I know writing books came into that, because you wrote two books that were sort of connected with your story of going out there and trying to be a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
And then after that, as you say, going to Huddersfield and running a retreat centre, but in your words, feeling like that failed, and now feeling like you're being repurposed for preaching. This is quite a change.
And it's not, I should say again, it's not that the retreat centre has failed, it's that what I've tried to do has failed. I am the one who has failed.
So you wanted the centre to be a sort of place where Christian artists, I should say those involved in the arts who are Christians, might be a better way of putting it, can come for sort of spiritual refreshment. But why hasn't that happened?
The sphere of influence that the retreat centre, and it runs well as a retreat centre, it's a great place to come. God does business with people there, and the other people who run it are brilliant. And the trustees are brilliant. So there is no criticism here of anyone. But the sphere of influence it has isn't the sphere of influence that I need to be able to grow this new thing. My skills are interpersonal and communication based, not administrative or logistical.
So was it out of this sort of instead that the preaching thing came from? Where does that fit in?
I don't really. No, I think that I realised for the first time in my career I was faced with a bad decision, like a real misstep. I think I've always been quite good at going where the niche was. And I thought I was doing that again. I thought I was creating a new niche and actually just hit a wall. I started taking a quarter of the gigs I've been doing beforehand so I could be there more. If you're on stage three nights a week, four nights a week, chemically you're never that low. Like your body never gets that low. You never crash. You know, it's like having a permanent caffeine high and permanent affirmation. And my addiction is words of affirmation. It's my love language, but it's my addiction as well. To scale all that back, like I crashed, like chemically and emotionally, just really crashed. because I just wasn't getting that drug. And then...
that drug, I guess, being in the form of applause at stand-up gigs or laughs at stand-up gigs.
People laughing, people coming up to you at the end and saying, well done. And to then suddenly be on the back end of a hill in the middle of nowhere where you're doing something you're not very good at, and even if you were good at it, people wouldn't tell you that. It's just... it's difficult. Character is what happens when personality doesn't get its own way. It's not the case that I should just buckle down and stay at the retreat centre, but actually whilst on there, there is a responsibility to, again, just not, as I said earlier, with, you know, Psalm 37, you don't stay down, you the Lord has your hand, and so you get up. So to answer the question, which I do remember this time, in the midst of all this, my friends Simon Holly and Steve Wilson at the King's Arms Church in Bedford said, do you want to come and do a gig for us and also stay on for this on the Saturday night and stay on for the Sunday morning and preach? And I thought they were joking, because I thought, like, you know me, like, this would be a nightmare. You want me to preach? Like, you're a church of 1,000 people, you want me to do the preach on the Sunday? They said, no, we this is what we want, this is what we think you should do. I sort of blagged it to a degree in terms of, I did my three best bits of material and I talked about Jesus around it, and five people made first time commitments to Jesus, and I came off stage feeling more exhilarated than I ever felt in my entire life, and thinking, oh, this is what I was born to do. Comedy has been my warm up act, as it turns out. And from that moment I thought, actually I want to preach the gospel. Wow. Because it doesn't mean I can't be a comedian. I am, that is who I am. I am a comedian. I can be funny, I can use all my best stuff, but actually there's something better than making people laugh. It's making people laugh and then telling them about the gospel. So the last 2 years have been interesting because I've got this growing birthing desire and calling and anointing to preach, whilst at the same time being in a valley and in desert and not being fully released to come out of that.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio on this Saturday afternoon with me, Sam Hales. It's The Profile, and I'm sitting down with Andy Kind. We recorded this interview in a pub in Eastbourne just before his stand-up gig. That's right, Andy Kind, the Christian comedian turned preacher, is my guest today, and you'll be hearing much more from him right after this.
Premier Christianity Magazine, in this month's issue.
Find out how the church reacted to the Grenfell Tower fire in our exclusive interview with Bishop Graham Tomlin. Plus, is hidden disappointment killing the church? We look at how to handle this difficult emotion and discover Christian views on gender and women's ministry in the church. Plus five miraculous stories, news, reviews and more. Out now in the June edition.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the magazine that sponsors this show. If you would like a free sample copy of the latest issue, we're the UK's leading Christian magazine, and you can get yourself a free copy, just head to premierchristianity.com/free sample. Simply type your details in and we would love to send you a free copy of the new edition out now. But it's time now to rejoin the conversation that I had with Andy Kind. There is a little bit of background noise in this interview. We recorded it in a pub just across from a church where Andy was due to perform later that Saturday afternoon. And then the next day at the same church, he's going to be preaching. So Andy Kind is a comedian turned preacher. I'm going to be finding out much more about what that means in the second half of my interview with him. Let's listen in.
You wrote something for the Christian website Threads a while back that I wanted to put to you again. You said the oral tradition that Christian comedy is not as good as secular comedy, a fact that is no longer true, has been passed down to a generation, and so young people, the 20s and 30s, who I primarily aim my comedy, often don't come along because of the preconceptions they have of what it will and won't be. If they don't come, they don't correct their thinking, the same message about the deficiency of Christian comedy gets passed to the next generation.
I'm so bombastic.
Do you still believe that?
Yes, I do. And I believe it's probably true with other things as well. So in a nutshell, what I'm saying is that we believe what we're told, don't we? And so...
Because there's still this perception, I think, not just with Christian comedy, but with Christian music, Christian film, Christian anything that, oh, if it's got the word, I mean, I work for a Christian magazine, oh, it's a Christian magazine. There's a perception, certainly amongst people in their 20s and 30s, although I'm sure other ages as well, that if the word Christian is before the thing, whether it's comedy or magazines or music, then that means it's not quite as good.
Exactly. And I think that's, and yet, if someone hears someone is a Christian doctor or a Christian lawyer, we think they must be better. For some reason, we think, oh, I trust, like, they must be amazing people and they must be better than normal doctors. So there's something about the arts. And actually, some Christian music isn't very good, but some of it's amazing, actually. And actually, even if it isn't really good, like, this is what God's called people to. It's not our place to tear them down because it's not our preference. There's a real, like, who reviews the reviewers? That's an article I want to write. Who reviews the reviews? You know, we've been so discipled by the X Factory of the age that we should just judge people based on our own preference, on our own sense of law. But yes, I think that people would instinctively say Christian music is rubbish, Christian comedy is rubbish. Well, if you haven't experienced it, then you're just not in a position to say. But where have you got that from? Let me give you another story, and I might talk about this in my preach tomorrow, actually. I know a guy, he definitely believes this, that he should never say sorry. And I said to him, well, why? What makes you think that? He said, well, that's just who I am. It's intuitive, he said. A while after that, he came up to me, because I gently tried to challenge him on this. Like, why do you, because he's a Christian guy, like, why do you think this? He came up to me and said, can I have a chat with you? You know when we said, like, where do you get the idea you shouldn't say sorry? He said, as a kid, I was a massive John Wayne fan. And there's it's either True Grit or The Searchers, where the John Wayne character says to his, like, young lad, never apologise, it's a sign of weakness. Yeah. And this guy said, I realised that that's where I got it from. I'd watched it so many times, because I was an avid John Wayne fan, I'd just taken it in. And so this idea that things are just intuitive and obvious and self-evident, it's not. We absorb. We've got to be really careful with our words. Because if you tell your kids evangelicals are bigots or liberals are weird or Christian music is rubbish, they'll believe you and they'll live as though that's true.
Yeah, but it just perpetuates
society. But it causes division and destruction. And it's.
By the same token, just before we came on air, you made a remark of, you know, say what you want, Sam, but please do not call me a Christian comedian.
Yes.
So by the same token, there is a problem with that particular phrase.
Yes.
And so the way I've heard it put is, and tell me if you agree with this, you'd say, oh, I'm not a Christian comedian, I'm a Christian who is a comedian. Mm. And there's a difference.
Yeah, I've described myself as that in the past, but yes, I think the problem is that we like certainty, don't we? So we'd like to pigeonhole. The Christian describes me. Christian comedian is not a proper noun. It's not capital C, capital C. It describes me, not the comedy. And like you see me, I am clean, and I'm not offensive, and I don't swear, and I don't use sexual gratuitousness. But those things are incidental. I'm not trying to be clean. I'm trying to be funny.
I remember you telling me that the problem with calling yourself a clean comedian is you said that people started to book you who are only interested in you being clean and not interested in you being a comedian.
Yeah, people come up and they'll say, oh, thank you so much, that was such a good night, so nice to hear someone not swear. I was like, but do you think it was funny? Like, oh, no, yeah, very good, but, you know, much better than those people on TV who use bad language. What do you mean much better? No, that's... You're making a moral judgment on something that's primarily creative. And
it's like the wrong category.
It's a category error, as philosophers would say, yeah. I hate the phrase Christian comedy because comedy's comedy. Mm-hmm. And Christian comedy is, it's jokes about the Bible and stuff like that. And none of the people I know who do comedy who are Christians do Christian comedy. They're Christians who do comedy. But they don't even go around describing stuff. They're comedians. My job title on my insurance forms, well, it says writer because it's cheaper, but it's, you know, it says comedian. And I think it's the connotations that are conjured up. When someone hears the phrase Christian comedy or Christian comedian, they picture something based on what they've had fed to them that has been passed down. And they think, well, that doesn't sound very good. I won't go to that. and people are pretentious. People are snobs. We're all snobbish, and we all have our own prejudices, however mild they can be. People are realizing now that worship music is probably at its the best it's ever been. You know, Christian music is probably the best it's ever been because we're exposed to it more, and there's more freedom. All the other arts are still behind that. Like, there's some amazing Christian dancers. Can you name any Christian performance pros? You probably couldn't name 5% of the Christians in comedy, and you've known me for like nearly 10 years, and you know other people as well.
But, calling me out.
Yeah, outing you as someone who doesn't know anything. So yeah, and I'm not saying that everyone has to champion everything, but the people who can should.
Mm. Some of that reminds me of some of the experiences I've had when you talk about some of the prejudice that goes on. I mean, I can think of church leaders who won't sit down for an interview like this. Understandably, perhaps, because they've been burnt in the past by journalists who's dealt with the story in an unethical way, and so this kind of becomes a, well, we can't touch journalism, I'd rather shy away from that. I mean, presumably you might have had similar experiences in the comedy world of there being Christians out there who do just think of the kind of Ricky Gervais atheist kind of comedy and think, well, we can't have any of that in the church.
I think that you have got to be wary, but actually there's something about giving people the benefit of the doubt, and like, just do not be afraid. Like, if people want to, in Acts 14, right, where Paul and Barnabas go into Derbe and Lystra, they've been in Lystra, they go along the A50 to Derbe. A lot of the Book of Acts is set in the East Midlands. You know that sound?
I didn't.
No. Yeah, it's true. And you'll have complaints about that. They preach the gospel, they get beaten up. Paul gets beaten up and thrown out of the city, and he goes back in. He gets up and he goes back in. He's totally fearless. They were fearless. And so people can say what they want about me as a comedian, me as an artist, me as a man. All opinions are available. Not all opinions are valid, but all opinions are available. And I can't control what people think. I have gone through phases of trying to control what people think. Even saying things, I'm still instinctively saying, don't say Christian comedian. But actually, I've always been described as a Christian comedian. I can't change it. I can't go door knocking around the country and say, please don't call me this. Because it's been 13 years and people still don't get the message.
It seems to me that you've had a very... you know,
easy life.
No, I mean, just in talking to you previously and reading some of the things you've written... It seems to me you've had a fairly love-hate relationship with the Christian world. There are times where you've sort of said, you know, a lot of the gigs I do are in churches, not all of them are, but, you know, a lot of them are, and I have to embrace that, and this is kind of my niche. And there have been other times where you've kind of railed against that and said, I don't want to be pigeonholed into that world, and actually I am out there in the clubs, and the church needs to support me in those venues too.
Yeah, I think I would probably... the some of that was obviously about my pride and insecurity. Actually, that... I am probably much more secure in my identity as a child of God now than I ever have been. And yes, I think in the past I have been so keen to show myself approved by the comedy world, or, you know, as a great beacon of Christian entertainment, that, yeah, I have been quite insecure, and I have attacked... No, I haven't attacked, but I have railed against aspects of, you know, Christendom. And rightly or wrongly, actually, that has been as a result of my own pride. And I suppose I'm just much more relaxed now. Of course, I don't want to be pigeonholed, and I'd like there to be more artistic freedom for me when I do church gigs. No, I don't have a love-hate relationship with the church anymore. I love the church, and I have been too proud and too self-indulgent at times. And it doesn't mean there's not a conversation to be had. Yeah, I think we do need to champion our artists more and give them more support. But actually, the church, people are doing their best, aren't they? And we get it wrong, but we're doing our best. And no one is deliberately getting it wrong, I don't think, most of the time.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I've definitely softened on that. As a result of having a massive failure over the last 2 years, I think you have much more grace for other people's shortcomings. What would it look like for me to have more freedom? I think
is this about, like, this might not be what you're saying, but is this about sort of pushing the envelope with the kind of jokes that you feel you can get away with in a church setting?
Yeah, I mean, I'm never trying to be crude. Like, comedy is just an extension of who you are, and I'm not withholding F-bombs here. I'm not like trying to not say them. That's not who I am.
No.
But I think it's more the, for instance, if I wanted to talk about the struggles that Christian men have with porn, I couldn't. Even if I'm a visiting preacher or a visiting entertainer, and I'm doing it from a position of trying to help us overcome that issue using humour. And that, on paper, that sounds great. Oh, comedy breaks down barriers and stuff. No, it doesn't work. Because the moment you mention porn, the whole room goes dead. Mm-hmm. The whole room goes dead. Why? Because we weren't expecting it. We're not used to talking about it. Lots of people have secret battles in the room. You know, the percentage of Christian men who have secret battles with porn. And so people shut down. Mm-hmm. And as a, I can still talk about it, but I won't get any laughter.
Right.
And I probably won't get any laughter for the rest of the gig.
And you could probably bring that up in the context of preaching, but what you're saying is in the context of going to a church and doing a comedy show.
Yeah.
That deadens the room and you,
easier
people,
is it?
People aren't willing to, I guess people aren't willing to laugh about that, even if, and comedy is often talked about in this way, that it is actually just telling the truth.
Yeah.
A lot of comedy, and that kind of makes us feel a bit uncomfortable when we laugh.
Yeah.
But, and that works with some subjects, but you're saying with pornography that wouldn't.
Yeah, and so that would be an example, but even things like, so the word you absolutely can't say, you won't expect, well, you can guess, what is the one word as a comedian doing the sort of gigs that I do that you cannot say? You won't guess, but the one word which is guaranteed to take all the air out of the room is racism. The word racism. Not being racist, but saying the word racism.
Really?
That's game over. I promise you. There's just certain things that all everybody, but I think particularly Christian audiences, are just worried about. And it's not because Christians are prudish. It's because they care. I used to say things like, it's prudishness and, you know, it's piety. No, it's because they care.
Right, yeah.
And they have a sense of justice. And they have a heart for people. And it grieves us when there's injustice. It grieves us when people are racist. So it's that. But yeah. What it means is that you're not free on stage to talk about whatever you want.
Right.
I'd love to speak. I did the article for Christianity Magazine last time about when Justin was still in charge. It was better then, actually. he said...
Miles better, I'm sure.
Because he got in touch with me and said, Justin Briley, and said, comedians are the new prophets. Can you write about that? I said, yeah, but I've got to say that they're not the new prophets.
I remember that. I remember having a conversation with Justin when we commissioned that. And so the idea was we wanted you to write this, as you say, this article that comedians are modern day prophets because they're out there and they're speaking truth to power.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're making all these really highly charged political points that change people's minds. And you're right. You came back and you said that's not true.
No, comedians are not prophets. They don't speak truth to power. They ego groom the people in front of them. They are yes men and snake oil salesmen. Generally speaking, like people only laugh at what they recognise. And most comedy in this country is about making people feel, the people in the audience feel better. But here, for now, we haven't, you know, Caleb's come back and said we need to take the land, but we haven't taken the land yet. I'm Caleb. How about that? No, I'm not. Ken Dodd was Caleb.
You talked before about having bad gigs. And presumably it's quite easy to measure what a bad gig is because people just don't laugh.
Yeah, so a bad...
Is that all it is?
Yeah, usually, yeah. It's what's interesting, as I preach a lot now, like you don't know what a bad preach is.
Yeah.
Because actually...
And actually, if you're in a band, you probably... I mean, it maybe if you hit lots of wrong notes, you might know. But even then, people, musicians talk about having a bad gig, and I always think, well, what does that look like?
Yeah, I think with music, you know, you do a song and people clap at the end. Well, that with comedy, you know you're having a bad gig because people don't laugh.
Right.
Actually, it still may not be a bad gig. If you're doing a gig on the north coast of Northern Ireland, they're just so confused as to why there's comedy there. I did a gig.
Really?
Yeah, church in Northern Ireland. Lovely, just beautiful people. Lovely, lovely people. But they were so scared, they didn't know what was going on, and I died. I thought I was dying. But loads of them came up with me and said, thanks for that, was really good. So, but why didn't you laugh? They just didn't know how, they didn't have that culture. But yeah, generally speaking, you know a bad gig because people aren't laughing. But whereas with a preach, actually, sometimes when they're the most silent, that's the best preach.
Yeah.
So I'm still learning that.
I want to talk more about preaching in a minute, but tell me about the best gig you've had.
I mean, there has been loads. There's been, as you would hope, after 2,000 gigs. Well, there's one I think I can think of.
I'm sure the majority were brilliant.
Yeah, the majority who, 97% are somewhere between good and great. Yeah. I think last year at New Wine, I retired from New Wine last year doing the after hours because the Lord said, you need to move out the way. If you want to preach on main stage, you need to step down from the comedy stage. And also you need to give some of the people you've been discipling a go. First time I performed at King's Arms in Bedford, again, it's always been a special place for me. Digbeth Vineyard Church in Birmingham was amazing. First time I did that. First time I'd done an hour. So it's always the seminal things. It's the first time you do an hour, first time you do an hour and a half, first time you do 2 hours, first time you get standing ovation. I would have traditionally said my Greenbelt show in 2008 when I got together afterwards with a girl who's now my wife. So that would be the most significant of gigs. But you know what?
Yeah, you don't repeat an experience like that.
You
right?
don't repeat an experience. Well, I hope not. Yeah, it's not totally impossible, but I hope not. But yeah, I currently don't have a favourite gig. But that one we went to in Southampton together, that was good.
I really enjoyed that gig. That was in a Costa Coffee in Southampton, and I mean, it was pretty obvious, even just for myself who knows nothing about comedy, that a huge amount of that gig was improvised and on the spot, which I just have a huge amount of respect for anyone who can improvise like that.
So the best type of gig, if I can spend most of my time, if I can spend like a third of the gig bantering and ad-libbing,
yeah,
I enjoy that the most. Because I know
and that
my
gig felt like 90% bantering.
It probably wasn't 90 because a lot of it's smoke and mirrors. I'm a snake oil salesman, remember? But I've always been known on the comedy circuit as someone who is really good at comping, really good at bantering, and good at ad-libbing.
But that's a real skill, I think. If someone like yourself who doesn't want to be rude, but you know what I mean, because a lot of bantering with people descends into mocking them.
Yeah, it can.
And to mock people in a way that is, I mean, you'll have the language for this in a way that I don't, but mocking people, a way of mocking people that's fun, that's good natured, that doesn't just descend into rudeness, I think is incredibly difficult.
But again, it's just an extension of who you are. So like I don't mock people in my life. Like I work really hard to honour people in my life, and so you just do that on stage, but you do it with jokes. And but my favourite sort of gig, if I can, because I know my material and I enjoy it, and you do new material and you enjoy that, but if you get to, you get more credit from yourself and from the audience if you create something out of nothing. Yeah. There's some spontaneous, you know, creation ex nihilo is, if it happens on a cosmic level or as a vignette in a comedy show, it's unbelievable.
I found this really great quote from you the other day that... I think you were asked, it was actually by the Evangelical Alliance, you were asked, what's your dream for society?
Oh, yeah.
Which is a wonderful question to ask,
yeah.
Which would almost imply that you are the next American president or something like that.
Yeah, I'm hoping to be POTUS.
But they asked you, what's your dream for society? And you gave the brilliant answer of, to see people living like Tom and Barbara from The Good Life, sustainable living, sharing resources, and tight-knit communities.
Yeah, you see, that's interesting. That was my social justice season. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I love Tom and Barbara from The Good Life, and what I've said I think I like, but so that was probably about 8 years ago now, and that wouldn't be my answer now.
Mm.
So
what was happening at that time that made you say that?
Well, I was quite newly married, and my wife used to work for a prayer and campaigning network, and she was very much, you know, that sort of social justice green belt type of Christian, and and she was really interested, and still is interested, in sustainable living, and so I kind of just got, we went through a gardening phase. We used to garden, we had
you're the first person I've ever interviewed who said I went through a gardening phase.
It was a phase, it was an addiction, and I'm clear of it now. I can't see a trowel, I can't be around trowels. I can't be around people who are eating trowels. I don't know what I'm talking about. So, I've always had this question about why is it that it seems that evangelical Christians can't believe in social justice, and why liberal Christians can't believe in the gospel. traditionally, I'm being flippant, but it's always seemed like there can be those two sides. Yeah, you either believe in preaching the gospel, you're either a missional Christian who preaches the gospel, or you're missional at inaugurating social justice. And so I think what was going on there was sort of widening myself out a little bit. But I would now say that, you know, my dream for society is to see people living from their identity as children of God. And that might seem a little bit trite, and maybe it is trite, but actually that is what I want, because I think that's what, you know, Galatians 4, 6 and 7, you are no longer slaves, but sons, and also by definition, daughters. I mean, that's just incredible. It's for freedom. Galatians 5, 1, it's for freedom that Christ has set you free. I think I was in my 30s before I realised the power of the gospel, as what the gospel is. The gospel is not stop being naughty or God will be angry. That's not the gospel. That's not repentance. Repentance is change your mind, turn away. Change your mind about what? About who you were born to be. And turn away towards what? Towards the guy who can give you that freedom, that sets you free and empowers you to be who you were born to be. I think there was I was bereft of people who were modelling, you know, biblical Christianity. I think biblical Christianity... I've had so much Diet Coke. But I think biblical Christianity is a merge of those social justice things, yeah, and the preaching of the gospel. I want to do what the guys in the Book of Acts were doing.
I think most evangelicals today would agree with you on that point. And I think there has been, even in my lifetime, a massive shift in how the average evangelical thinks, yeah, about social justice.
Yeah.
But it's really refreshing, Andy, you know, to hear you talk so honestly and openly about things you said before that you've changed your mind on or have a different slant,
yeah,
on.
Yeah. Which is pretty much everything you've quoted me on. So I don't believe that anymore.
I think that's refreshing, and it's clearly healthy that you're in a different place to where you were. But I want to draw you a bit more on that with what you said a moment ago about new wine, and the kind of the way you put it was, well, I need to sort of stop doing the after hours comedy stuff. And now I feel called to preaching. But you know, you also said the first preach you gave was 2/3 of your comedy set.
Yeah.
So how do you see those two things in the future?
So I want the preaching to overwhelm, come out from the middle of and then overwhelm, like grow up from inside of the comedy and overwhelm it ultimately. You know, so you have to have good soil in order for things to sprout and grow. I told you I had a gardening phase, you remember?
There it is, it's coming back.
It's coming back, isn't it? So yeah, comedy is the soil from which the preaching grows out of. But I think it's more about how I am seen. Like, I am known
You're
as...
known as a comedian.
As the comedian.
But Christian comedian, yeah, in some circles.
In some circles. But yeah, as a comedian. And as actually, you know, so there are certain Christian festivals where I was never allowed on the main stage because I wasn't trusted. I was trusted at the after hours, but I wasn't trusted anywhere else.
Right.
Because they thought I'd be a bit naughty. And I would have been a bit naughty, because I am a child, and I am playful. But you know,
I think it's fun to have a preacher who's a bit naughty, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but I think it was mainly. So it was the two things. You know, I spend some of my time, some of my effort goes into trying to champion young Christians, or, you know, less experienced Christians who are coming onto the comedy scene. I try and get them to be my support acts. I try and spend time with them. I run workshops for them. I want to champion them and disciple them and model something for them. And some of those guys are now at the stage where they're ready for the big festivals. And because I've been hogging it, me and Paul Carenza, I have to move out of the way. Because otherwise, you know, Robbie Dawkins, again at New Wine a few years ago, said, your main calling in any ministry is to equip those coming up behind you so they can stand on your shoulders. So there's that. It's getting out of the way so other people can have a go. But it is also about saying, look, if you want to be taken seriously as a preacher, there's just certain things that you can do.
Yes.
To surrender that. Yeah, to help, to surrender, kind of lay down your arms from the previous battle. So I'm not doing any Christian festival. I'm not at Spring Harvest now. I'm not going to New Wine. I'm not doing anything. I won't do it, because actually I just need to have, there needs to be a break. There needs to be a fallow season.
It seems quite nice in the meantime that you can do a bit of both. So you're about to go on stage and do this stand-up. How long are you playing for tonight?
I'll do about an hour and a half.
We'll do an hour and a half tonight of stand-up comedy, and then the next morning you're going to be preaching at the church that you did.
I'm doing all three services, yeah.
At the church you did the stand-up the night before, so that's kind of fun.
So that's good, because actually preaching doesn't pay. Comedy pays.
Okay.
So yeah, my new resource is that I do the Saturday night comedy, and they pay me for that because that's my job.
Yeah.
And then I preach for free on the Sunday. So they get something, I get something, and it's a good relationship. And also we go on a journey together over the weekend. So I'll do all three services tomorrow, having had a nice time tonight, hopefully.
Fantastic. And I want to finish just by talking about your books a little bit, because I know that's a huge part of your career we haven't really touched on at all. I understand you're writing at the moment a sequel to a previous book, is that correct?
That is correct, thank you. I am writing a sequel to The Unfortunate Adventures of Tom Hillingthwaite, which is the third of my three books, and the first with me not in it. So it's a third person comedy novel about an evangelist who moves from a really middle-class area to quite a rough area called Bruton, which may or may not sound like the place it's based on. He tries to build community, but the thing about him is that he's the worst evangelist in the world. And so it's quite interesting, because it's about... I wanted to tell a funny story about someone who is called but not capable. Called but not equipped. And the story's about lots of things, but it's really about our identity is simply in who we are, not what we're good at. So it's the story of Tom being moving to this place and just being terrible. He's not a good evangelist. He doesn't lead anyone to the Lord. And his wife leads loads of people to the Lord easily. His daughter at school, she starts like this little mini alpha thing. Even his cat leads someone to the Lord, but he doesn't do it. And it's about that struggle, that questioning, like, what is God doing? But it's a real redemption story, because he learns where his worth is, and that it's not really about him, and it's not about performance. It's kind of railing against that middle class Christianity that says you have to strive for something. What I really was keen not to do was to tell a trite twee Christian novel. So at the end, spoiler alert, he loses his job. The Christian ministry he's working for just summarily sacks him. And he loses his house and he has to leave. So the end of the story is him taking his family away, having been disgraced in a sense. And I really wanted it to be an honest story about the struggles of working in Christian ministry. It's not on Christians good people, on atheists bad people. Like, I want to tell funny stories well, but from the Christian world. So it's about the Christian world in the same way that, you know, a Charles Dickens novel is about the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. It's just set there. But yeah. I just want to tell really good, funny stories which have a heart and communicate something of the gospel. So that's it.
So where can people go to get the first one and your other two books?
Yeah, well, I like to promote Eden.co.uk. There's any of the major bookselling websites you can go to. But Eden are cool. I like them. And so go there. Or you can come to one of my gigs and buy them off me there.
Even better. Well, I'm going to let you go, Andy, get to this gig, but I couldn't really let you go without asking the question that I've been wanting to ask for the whole of this interview, and that is, as a travelling comedian, what is your favourite service station?
Oh, yes. Well, thank you so much. And it's not like... most comedians say that one north of Manchester on the way to the Lake District on the M6. My favourite one, bizarrely... is Corley Services, which is south of Birmingham on the M6. Because if I'm doing a long trip to the south, it's usually halfway, and it's the one I stop at. And it's got a lovely big car park, and it makes me feel really comfortable. So it's Corley Services. But I like Warwick and Oxford on the M40 as well.
Okay, they're good runner-ups.
Yeah, they're good runner-ups, yeah.
All right, great. Well, Andy, I'm going to let you go get to this gig. I hope it goes really well, and I hope the preaching goes well tomorrow.
Thanks, mate.
As well. Thank you so much for being on the programme today. It's been great to have you.
It's been my pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Profile this Saturday afternoon. I've been Sam Hales interviewing the comedian-turned-preacher Andy Kind. We'll see you next week.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holidayinstall to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.